Our second speaker this morning is our brother Ron Cowie of Golden Grove Ecclesia in South Australia. The theme for our brother Ron's classes this week is Look Unto the Rock from Whence You Are Hewn. Today's class is entitled Joseph, Coping in a Dysfunctional Family. Brother Cowie.
Dear brethren and sisters and young people, in our so-called enlightened age, having a bad or a difficult family background is used to excuse all kinds of irresponsible and sometimes criminal behaviour. In Australia, we find in our courts that the classic defence of the guilty is that they had a poor background. You know, you have people up there on murder and all kinds of violence charges, and the defence is always the same. That sometime when this poor soul was 3 years old, he was somewhere spanked by his parents, and someone took away his lollies when he was five, and therefore he's not really responsible for the murder and the crime that he's committed. Which is of course a product of the Freudian philosophy that we are all products of our culture. And that has permeated our society and our laws, and so that criminals are pardoned or put on suspended sentences because they're not really responsible for what they did. And you can see there from this particular cartoon that that is even acknowledged by society, that people are dysfunctional. Their families are dysfunctional, therefore they're not personally responsible. And it's that particular matter we want to address today by looking at the character of Joseph. That situation is not so with God. God expects us to take personal responsibility for our own actions and our own lives. If ever there was a dysfunctional family that you could blame, it was the family of Joseph. And we're going to learn from Joseph and perhaps learn what we and our children need to know about accepting personal responsibility. Now the life of Joseph was a most remarkable life. He was, as we know, the greatest ever type of the Messiah, of the sufferings and the glory that would follow. There's over 200 allusions and parallels and connections to the life of Christ. Incredibly precise in their foreshadowing. And we marvel at exactly how it was that God shaped the life of Joseph to show the life of Christ. It was also a life that was very much involved with the providence of God. Yahweh was with Joseph in all his ways. But let's remember that from Joseph's viewpoint, he had absolutely no idea where his life was leading. At 17, he began a roller coaster ride of life, traumatic ups and downs, and he had no concept of where it would all end up. Dramatic events shattered his warm relationship with his father. He was sent away from his family to live on his own in Egypt for a number of years. He had no warning or explanation of what it was all about from God. He had no idea he was portraying a type of anybody that was to come. From Joseph's point of view, it was all particularly confusing. He had no voice of God to come to him and to say, Joseph, this is why it's happening to you. He had no visit from angels that he actually recognized. He had no visions of God to say, this is the purpose. He had no miracles in his life that he could see. We need to remember that of all the lives of providence, Joseph was perhaps the greatest example of the hand of providence working in an unseen fashion. All he had were some dreams. And as time went by, those dreams began to look less and less likely to come to pass. And for 20 years, Joseph had to grapple and to comprehend what was going on in his life. And sometimes our lives in the truth and life in our families is a bit like that. We wonder where God is taking us. And we have to have the same faith as Joseph, that God has a purpose in all that he puts us through. In those years when Joseph was alone in Egypt, he showed remarkable tenacity. There was no one there in Egypt to encourage him, no one to confide in, no one to sympathise with his plight. And yet we know that he maintained his integrity and his faith in the face of misery, in the face of chains, imprisonment, tears, and extreme loneliness. He never wavered from his father's principles and ideals when he was away from his family. And the great point of Joseph's life is that we have to accept personal responsibility for our own walk in the truth. When Joseph did that, and because Joseph did that, he was able to move on to save his brethren. Now let's look at the family that Joseph came from. If ever there was a dysfunctional family, this was it. The range of ages between the children in that family were extreme. It seems perhaps that Judah was a number of years, perhaps 20 odd years, and Reuben even further ahead of Joseph. So there was a wide range of ages amongst the children of that family. Through circumstances, Jacob had a family where there were multiple wives and handmaids that he'd also married. They were constantly fighting and bickering amongst themselves, so there was hardly a happy home for Joseph to grow up in. There was incest. It seems that Bilhah had seduced Reuben, perhaps in retaliation for some of the bitterness amongst the wives. And so there was this incest, a shame that was never forgotten in that family. Dinah had been defiled by the Gentile at Shechem. There were two motherless sons, Joseph and Benjamin, whose mother had died when Benjamin was born. And Joseph was only about 5 years old. There was bitter hatred and envy amongst the brothers. They envied and hated Joseph. And their envy was such that they were willing to see him put to death. Judah had married out of the truth. When we put the chronology together, as we do in our next class, you'll find that by the time that Joseph comes onto the scene, Judah has already married a Canaanite. And that was right against the family principles. And so that was another shame to the family. And they were living in fear of the Canaanites. Ever since what happened at Shechem, they were living in fear of Canaanite retribution. So here was a family that was extremely difficult in its circumstances. It was not a good family to grow up in. And we can learn a lot from Joseph's personal responsibility in that dysfunctional family. Now let's just look at the record in Genesis 37 very quickly and just pick out one or two factors as we go along. We find in verse 1 that they are still dwelling in the land where their father was a stranger. So they're still maintaining the pilgrim spirit in the land. You need to notice that chapter 37 is in direct contrast to chapter 36. When you read the record of the family of Abraham, you wonder what chapter 36 is doing there. It's all about the power and prestige of Esau. And it's there to make a contrast to chapter 37. And when you go through chapter 36, the emphasis is upon power, prominence, cities, possessions, places, castles, armies, titles, dukes, princes. And it's all about the power and the pomp of the flesh that Esau's family had come to. If you look at verse 39 and verse 40, for example, they had cities, their places, their names, the dukes, their habitations, their possessions. And you see, Esau's family had got themselves well established in the things of this life. And that's the contrast between these two chapters. They reeked of power and permanence and materialism. When Esau came to meet Jacob, he had 400 bodyguards. What did Jacob have? A bunch of shepherds. When Jacob's family went down to Egypt, there were 66 of the family that went into Egypt, and most of those were children. And so the family of Jacob was at this stage much, much smaller than the family of Esau, and far less established. They were still living the pilgrim life in tents. And Jacob is desperately trying to keep his family separate from the Canaanites. Dinah had failed, Judah had married a Canaanite, and the older brothers were up to mischief behind Jacob's back. Look what it says in verse 2. Joseph had to bring to his father their evil report. But the scripture is quite clear in verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob, Joseph. And only one son is named. Where are the rest of the generations of Jacob? Well, that's telling us he only had one real son who did the works of his father. Chapter 36 tells us that all of Esau's sons were like Esau. They were all dukes and princes and powerful and profane men. But Jacob only had one son to continue the Abrahamic faith. And we find in verse 2 an exhortation to every teenager and to parents of teenagers. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old. Whenever the Bible puts something in like that, it's telling us to have a close look at it. God is encouraging our teenagers to think about their personal responsibility. At 17 years, Joseph is ready for the trials of life that were to come upon him. He does expect conviction in youth. We are never too young to take responsibility for others. Now, sometimes we get the impression that Joseph was a bit of a wimp, a bit of a weakling. Well, it says there he was feeding the flock with his brethren. And when you go back and you read what feeding the flock involved when Jacob was looking after the flocks of Laban. You find that was a very hard life. Cold and frost by night, burning sun by day, responsibility for sheep. He had learned a lot, and he was a tough young man, was Joseph. But he's out there with his brothers, and he soon found himself in conflict with his brothers and their evil deeds. He was absolutely clear on what was right and wrong, and he knew that what they were doing was wrong. And he was prepared to be different. Now we notice he was with the sons of the handmaids, and that was Dan, Naphtali, Gad and Asher. They appeared to have been a distinct group amongst the sons of Jacob, and they were up to no good. Now why would that group particularly be the ones that were up to no good? Well, they were the sons of the handmaids. They were sons of slaves, and they felt and resented the fact that their mothers were not of the same status as the other two wives in that family. Their mothers had been sold as part of a package deal. Their mothers were not spiritual, as we see from the record. And they'd fed their bitterness onto their sons. And as we said, Bilhah seems to have seduced Reuben, who was 20 years her junior. Sometimes it's a very sad fact of life that those who feel underprivileged, those who feel that they're inferior, make the decision to live up to people's expectations. If they think that of us, well, we might as well be like that. And instead of proving themselves to be different, the sons of the handmaid were proving themselves to be sons of the handmaid. But we don't have to fail just because we've come from an inferior background. Think of Rahab, think of Ruth, think of Atteo the Gittite. There are many examples in the Bible of people who made good after an unpromising start. And Joseph never gave up because he came from a crazy mixed up family. Joseph decided to do something about it and to take responsibility. And so it says there, at the end of verse 2, he brought unto his father their evil report. And I would reckon that many teenagers who read that would probably start to cringe. I don't know what word they use in America for, amongst the teenagers, for people who tell on other teenagers. In Australia, the word they use is a dobber, or a lagger, somebody who goes and tells the adults what the other young people are up to. Very simply, he got them into trouble. He told on them. It is one of the saddest products of the humanistic age that there is pressure on our young people to protect the wrongdoers. It's as strong in our youth circles as it is in the world. And there's huge pressure on other young people to not say anything when something unseemly is being done. It's been my experience to work with young people quite a bit over the last few years. And we've seen this time and time again. Whenever something unseemly is uncovered, whether it be drugs or immorality, whenever it comes to light, you find that there are a number of young people who knew it was happening and said absolutely nothing. In fact, we had a case recently where we had red-hot information about some who had been smoking at a youth weekend. Now, we knew who they were. And when we got all the parties involved into a room and we said, who was it that actually brought the cigarettes along? It took us, three hosts, it took us an hour to get a confession. Now, they all knew the full story, but it took us an hour of persevering with those young people to get a confession. We knew who it was, but we wanted them to confess. And in the end, one of them finally said, I know who did it, but I don't want to be a lagger. And this was the pressure that they felt amongst themselves. And it turns out, you know, that in the end, we still weren't told the full story, because one of them had been threatened that if you say anything, we will get you and we will never ever speak to you again. Now that just shows you the incredible pressure that's put on other young people to protect the guilty. You know, it's almost like the mafia, isn't it? You get rid of those who might dare to mention something. But that pressure is there amongst young people, and it's a strong pressure, and we've got to train our young people to understand that it's right by God to get help for those who've got a problem. If sin is protected and it goes on with its leaven being unchallenged, then we're going to see more people dragged into the problem. But when you're 15 or 16 years old, there's a tremendous pressure upon you to say nothing. And we have to train our young people to understand that true friends are those who will not let you die True friends are those who will get you the help that you need if you've got a problem. We cannot let people destroy themselves and ruin the lives of others. We cannot let God be shamed by the deceit that is being practiced. And if we become aware of a problem, then we have a responsibility to God and to others to get them some help. And we have to get our children to understand that those who speak up are the true friends. They can see the long-term perspective. But that's very hard for young people to do. But Joseph was clear that there was either right or wrong, there were absolute rights with God, and he told his father of what they were doing. I might just make a note here for parents or for responsible brethren who sometimes have this information given to them. If young people do come to you with information, always make sure that you act wisely and carefully with that information, because one of the reasons that young people are reluctant to speak is that they have seen overreactions. They have seen brethren lose their tempers and go right off the deep end, and they've seen reputations of young people ruined for life because some sin was blatant abroad. It's very important when we come possessed of that information to react correctly. We might be horrified, we might be indignant, but it's important that we react correctly in the eyes of the young people so that they feel confident that the information has achieved the right end, and that is to help the person that's got the problem. Always remember, we hate the sin, we hate the immoral practice. We've got to love the person and recover the person that's involved. Let's always remember that sometimes the silly things young people do are because they are young, and they will grow up, they will mature, they will grow out of these things. And so we've got to be firm. We've got to deal with the problem. We've got to be clear on what is right and wrong, but be encouraging and always be in the spirit of recovery to try and ensure that we can win those back for God. And so Jacob, having heard the evil report, worried about these sons. And in verse 14, we find that he sends Joseph to see if it be well with them. But what a contrast it was in his own family to see these different sons and their different reactions. It says in verse 3, he loved Joseph more than his other children. Well, one of the reasons was that he looked like Rachel. There's no doubt about that. But there was much more to it than that. It was mainly because Joseph was a godly and a responsive son. And it is never wrong to love a godly child. It does not mean that we do less for disobedient children. But we must encourage holiness and we must encourage excellence in spiritual things. Favoritism amongst children is only wrong if it's based upon worldly attributes. Look at Isaac, who favoured Esau because Esau was a mighty hunter. That was wrong. If we favour our children because they're academically brilliant or they're good at sport or talented or careers, because they're rich or good looking, if we favour for the wrong reasons, that's wrong. But it is not wrong to favour a godly child and to encourage that spirituality with all of our fibre. The other reason that Joseph was a godly child was that Jacob had time to spend with Joseph and with Benjamin. He'd been caught in a situation working for Laban where he didn't have time to put into his older sons and daughters. The first 40 years of Laban's service, he was all day and night with the flocks. Pretty hard life supporting 4 wives, 10 boys and a girl. And there he was, leaving his children largely to the care of their mothers. But now Jacob is 110 years old. He's got grown sons who can mind the flocks. He's got 2 young boys left without a mother, and he's going to put all his time into those boys. And I've no doubt he looked at his older sons and he saw the problem of not spending enough time with those older boys. Brethren and sisters, there is no substitute for time and quality time spent with our children. And that doesn't always mean having the Bible open. That means just spending time talking to our children. And I think I said to you on the opening night that having got to this stage of life, there are some things I would do differently. And one of them is I would love to have spent more time with my children while they were young. Take that as a lesson. There is no substitute for the time you spend with your own children. Get them away from their computer games. Get them out of their rooms. Spend time with them as a family. There's no substitute, and Joseph and Jacob developed a wonderful relationship because of the time that Jacob now had. Well, we find that there was hatred in the family. Jacob gave him this coat of palms, this tunic of palms, it's called. Not a coat of many colours, it was a priestly garment of the firstborn. It nominated him as the chosen heir of the blessings of Abraham. And the symbol of Jacob's love became to the brothers the object of hatred. And later they ripped that garment up and brought it to Jacob and said, "Is this your son's coat or no?" Well, unfortunately, his brothers hated him because of the favouritism his father showed. They also hated him because of his dreams. We read in verse 5, he dreamed a dream and they hated him yet the more. The same in verse 8, they hated him yet the more. And again in verse 11, they envied him. So it was a disappointing response that Joseph got from his brethren. When he began to speak of things spiritual, he got a very disappointing response from his brothers. In fact, it says in verse 4, they could not even speak a peaceable word to him. I want you to notice though, and here's one of the clues of the coping in a dysfunctional family. When you can't even discuss the truth, when others don't want to talk about it, when they hate you all the more for the things that you say, imitate Joseph. He did not stop speaking about those things. Look at verse 5. He dreamed a dream and he told it his brethren. And again we find in verse 9. He dreamed another dream and he told it his brethren. Now they couldn't speak peaceably to him. They didn't want to talk about the spiritual things of life. He kept talking. And so we learn from Joseph that we've got to keep talking about the things of the truth, even if that's not popular. His brethren knew he was different. You know, in verse 19 of chapter 37, when they see him coming, they say, "Behold, this dreamer cometh." And if you've got a margin, you'll see it says, "This master of dreams cometh." Now he's 17, and they had already categorized him a master of dreams because he sought to understand. He was trying from the family history of the interpretation of dreams to understand what God was saying. Brethren and sisters, we need to educate our children to be masters of dreams. The deity delights in stimulating the intellect of his creatures. He loves those who weep to understand. And we have to encourage our children to want to know the meaning of the hidden things of the Bible. We've got to encourage the understanding of Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 10, of Revelation, of all the prophecies. We have to encourage that spiritual thinking in our children to become masters of dreams and to have that inquiring mind. So the time came that Joseph was sent to seek his brothers. And we find in verse 13 that Israel said to Joseph, "My brethren feed the flock in Shechem. Come, I will send thee unto them." It was hardly a good prospect for Joseph to go off to look for his brothers who severely hated him. It was a 70-mile journey, and yet he said in verse 13, "Here am I, send me." Joseph knew that his brothers were not to be trusted. It was not a very pleasant task at all, but he went willingly, and we've got to encourage in our children that spirit of willingness, that spirit of cooperation. Not when you say, "Look, would you go and set the table," you get the sulks and banging things down and walking around. We've got to have a spirit in our children of willing obedience. We also have to teach our children, our young people take notice of this, it is not funny to dodge work. You know, I've been at ecclesial working bees where some young people think it's very amusing to keep walking around looking like you're busy and laughing at those who got caught having to do something. It is not funny to dodge work. We need an attitude that says, "Here am I, send me." And from a young age, we ought to be encouraging our children to be volunteers at ecclesial functions, to offer to help, to be out there doing the dishes when the dishes need to be done. We need to encourage our young people to think about how they might help those who are less fortunate than themselves. And the spirit of willingness is something that was evident in Joseph. And so he came to Shechem, seeking his brethren, as we read in verse 14. Now Shechem is a most interesting place in the scriptures. We haven't got time to follow it right through, but basically Shechem in the scriptures has two significances. One is a place of decision, and you will find numerous examples of people who came to Shechem to make decisions in their life. Abraham came to Shechem and decided to go on into the land. He built altars in Shechem. Jacob built altars at Shechem. Dinah made a decision to go and see the daughters of the land, which was disastrous. Jacob's house had to cleanse themselves of their idols. Deuteronomy 13, Israel were told there to come to Shechem and choose life. Joshua 24, choose this day whom you will serve. Judges 9, the men of Shechem chose Abimelech. Rehoboam came to Shechem. The ten tribes chose Jeroboam. And Shechem is a place where people make decisions about their life. And Jacob's sons had made a bad decision at Shechem. So it's a place of decision. It means the burden bearer. A place where you decide whether or not to accept your responsibilities in life. And here people came to make choices. Well, Joseph gets there and there's nobody there. They had made a choice to leave the well of Jacob. You see, that's why they were at Shechem, because that was the well that Jacob owned in the land. It's the well that he had dug, and that was the family inheritance where they should have been. But they'd gone on to Dothan, and Dothan means two wells. They wanted to have it both ways. And when they got to Dothan, they found that the wells were empty, because seeking after the things of the world is always empty. They'd gone on to the more interesting trade routes. They decided to go over where the action of life was, to get a sniff of the pleasures of Egypt, to see the spice of life that was going down to Egypt. They were seeking for a bit of amusement. And poor Joseph is left wandering around looking for them. He's greatly distressed. He probably imagined that perhaps the men of Shechem, who were still rankling from what had happened with the incident of Dinah, the Canaanites of that area would perhaps have taken retribution against his brothers. And he's quite distressed. And we read in verse 15 that the language is extremely specific. It says, a certain man found him. Now it doesn't say that he went to ask for directions. What it says is that a certain man found him. So we see, it's alright, don't worry about it, he's wandering in the field, a certain man found him. Now,